Welcome to the podcast, States and Migration in Europe. Today, we are discussing about the organization Por Causa from Madrid in Spain with the co-founder and director of the organization, Lucila Rodriguez Alarcón. Welcome, Lucila.
Hello, thank you, Manuel.
So Por Causa is an organization based in Madrid, in Spain, and it has been created a few years ago, and it has already developed a reputation for reacting to the trend of immigration restrictions in Western countries. You started with thinking that the main problem was that the way information was presented, and so you wanted to address this question, but then you seem now to consider that there is something deeper.
All the stories of migration are stories about people dying or people being incredibly successful. So it's like, oh no, but this guy was a migrant and look, he built an empire. Or people dying in the sea or dying in a fence. And at the end, migration is not that. This is just like the smallest part of the migration process. And the low represents the travels of a very low quantity of people. Most of the people come from the airport by legal ways, and they face, of course, problems or success, but on an average way.
Yeah, I was thinking that this idea of migrants being incredibly successful is something more American than European, actually. It's more common to have that in the American media context. Oh, in Europe as
for
well?
Example, yes. Remember, you have a success story of a migrant in your country who got all the who got immediately regulated because he saved someone that was on a building and he jumped, and you remember this guy?
Yes.
This is a success story too.
Yes, yes. Yes. And there is another type of frame when dealing with migration, is rather the fear. So you mentioned that the tragedies of migrants dying or the incredible success stories. But you have also the fear of migrants, that is migrants that are potentially dangerous for natives. For instance, there was recently a case of a migrant from Algeria in France, a lady who attacked with a knife people in the street in Paris. What kind of impact are you trying to achieve?
We are not, we don't do advocacy or lobbying. We just try to get information to get consumed. And we succeed. So it works.
Why do you say it works?
Because we have been working on migration. Specifically on migration for 7 years, and we have great success stories already. The most recent ones will be in 2020. We began to work to get all the information about regularization of migrants in Spain, because it was the COVID, and Italy and Portugal began a process of regularization, and we thought it was also a chance in Spain. We knew that the Ministry of Migrations wanted to do a regularization because we worked with them at the beginning, and we knew they wanted, but they were very scared about the social pressure against regularization. So we began to work, and we did a paper on to help the people to understand what regularization was, what were the figures of people in an irregular situation, and what would be the consequences of special regularization. Then the president of Spain went to fight for the recovery budget, and we think Germany said, okay, you cannot do an exceptional legalization in Spain, so forget it. But for 2 years, we had this information, and then we have people got conscient about the fact that regularization will help the economy, will change the frame of lots of people, help to get the workers with the same level of responsibilities too, because at the end, to have a regular situation gives you some privileges, but also that are not privileges. At the end, is like rights, no? Gives you access to rights, but also gives you access to responsibilities. And then a group of migrants that they create an association just at the same time we were doing this thing with the information. And by in 2021, we began to work together. And right now we have been able to recover more than 600,000 signatures, with a coalition with 800 organizations in a historic social movement based on the information we have produced that is for all audiences. And
this is for the program of regularization of migrants, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And everything began with our work.
I see.
So, and it involves media, it involves researchers, it involves storytellers. So, and I think this is a success story. Like, it's not that we are the only ones part of it. It is a success story because we are able to gather lots of people and gather also their knowledge and what they can bring. So, it's a... You know that the car doesn't work only because there is one piece in the engine, but that there are several. So we will be like the one busting, simply. Information is the beginning of everything.
So I, just so that I understand, though, you are, you manage, you say that you are successful because you manage to create a movement around certain causes. For instance, no, the regularization of migrants. You create a broader social movement around a cause, as you say, for the cause.
Yes, we think we are successful because you begin providing information to a public space, and then because the public debate changes, things change. We are not the one changing the things. We are just changing the public debate. But this is the origin of lots of changes after. This is, at the end, what a journalist or a storyteller aims to do. You are not telling a story just to be read. You tell a story because you want this story to provoke changes.
So, and those changes are of the type of, for instance, this social movement for regularization of migrants in Spain with this large number of signatures. Or do you have other examples of changes?
No, we have more examples. One other, for example, something that was very specific. We did a research on the Melilla, which is the town that is in the border with Morocco within Africa. It's a Spanish town. There are Ceuta and Melilla are two towns located in Africa, and there is Spanish. And Melilla had a corrupt government that had been there for like 26 years. Everybody said to us that it was impossible to move the situation. And this government was on the basis of lots of aggressions to migrants and mainly young migrants underage that were traveling without their parents. And the situation in Melilla was terrible, and that was mixed with corruption. And we did a research. It took us 2 years. And we tried to publish it first in a big media in Spain, and it was published, but it was, the information was not published, the whole information, because there were interests that had this paper not to publish the whole information we had. And it took us 6 months to find another big paper, and it was El Confidencial, and we could publish the whole investigation, but it was published in a way so it could be interesting for any reader. The way it was presented, it's called Melilla Vice. If anyone is hearing it, Melilla Vice, I really, truly recommend that they check it. It's still online. And the government changed. There were elections.
All right. So what was the story of in Melilla Vice? And starting with what the first paper had not wanted to publish, because what is censored is generally the most interesting.
It was a story about lots of companies at national level and local level getting the money from the industry of migration control and getting rich because thanks to this system of management of the border, trying to prevent the people to cross instead of trying to create a system that allows the flows. And this is another of, this is one of our other biggest big success, is that we have introduced in the European debate the concept of industry of migration control. We were the first of using this concept, and right now you have lots of media using this concept of industry of migration control. There is an industry that lives thanks to the migration control. And Melilla is a city that lives thanks to the migration control. People get lots of money thanks to that, which is money that shouldn't be to enrich local people. It should be to create a system of real management of the flows. So that was the thing that we were telling, and there were interests of big, big companies that had investments on the main society that was the hosting the paper, the big, big paper. I won't tell the name, but it's the biggest paper in Spain. And it was complicated for the paper to publish that.
All right. So this is money that comes from the government, from Madrid, and as well, I suppose, from the European Union. And yes, this money goes to Melilla as a border city of the EU, and is supposed to serve to control migration at the external border. And yet, you show in your investigation that this money basically helps certain people to some people profit excessively from this public money, and this public money is not reaching exactly the purpose it's supposed to reach, and it's turned by some local interests in their favor. Correct?
Yes. And we got to that by changing, and this is why I'm saying that we have created our own system. When everybody was talking about people lying in the sea or the trips that were killing people and so, we said, okay, we know who is losing with this system. We know that migration is necessary for humanity. Like human beings, we need to migrate to move. It's the way we get balance. The world at the end, if we allow everybody to move, we will find a natural balance. So it's good for the economy of the countries that of origin, is good for the countries that receive migrants. So there's a lot of people losing their lives with this system, but someone has to be winning something. Because if not, this system wouldn't prevail. And this is why we ended with this term of industry of migration control. We discovered
I understand you don't want to give exact names of, but to make it a little bit more concrete, who are those who profit? I mean, in general terms, who are those who profit from this industry and how?
No, the names of the people profiting from the industry, you have it in our reports.
Yes.
Perfectly. You can read them in Por Causa's webpage, and you have it in English too. Most of the reports of the industry of migration control are translated. Those are like top companies of mainly defense, construction. Those companies, the top 10 are involved on industry of migration control. And we don't know the amount, the precise amount that they're really getting. But for example, if you think about their lobby in Europe is the one in the research and innovation. They have the commissions of research and innovation. They're providing with systems that are biometrics. If you are interested in migration, you all have heard about the systems of face recognition and that are designed to identify people with a certain phenotype and things like that. That comes from researchers paid by the European Commission. And once you implement this system, then you have to pay every year to update the system. So we're talking about an industry that really, really moves thousands of millions of euros a year.
So billions of euros, yes.
With big companies involved. And even the structure of hosting the migrants when they come to the countries is part of the industry of migration control, which is quite sad. But all these structures in Spain, for example, Red Cross is part of the system of migration control. And they get money and they get resources. Because there's people who are not allowed to have a normal life in the countries when they get. And they're part of the system. And the main structure in Spain for refugees management, which is called FEAR, they had, when we began with, before the crisis of the Syrian movement, before this exodus, they had half a million euros budget a year. And one year, they got 7 million of budget. Suddenly, they grow from half a million to 7 million. They were not able to manage this amount of money. They might be good people there, but everything is over. So how you know that the resources are well organized and at the end, if you take out the resources, you're taking this organization down. They die. They're 100% funded by public money.
So could you explain a bit more what was this organization and what it was doing?
This is, I was talking about specifically the organization who is responsible to help the refugees when they come to Spain. It's one of the three big organizations. This one is the main one. Mm-hmm. So all the growth came from public money. Instead of building public structures and resources to manage the refugees' needs, what they do is they found an NGO who will manage that. But at the end, this NGO is part of the industry of migration control. Mm-hmm. If you don't have refugees, you don't have an organization, you don't have money. Mm-hmm. So it creates like everything is a bit, there is a perversion, no?
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, that's very interesting. And it reminds me of It reminds me of Donald Trump. On the other side of the Atlantic, there was this, I don't know if you had watched this movie from the late 1990s from Emir Kusturica. It was titled Underground. And I think it's a movie in three sections. And in the second section, you had the corrupt Yugoslav politician whose name is Marko. And he's campaigning to be very close to Tito in socialist Yugoslavia, and we see him making speeches, and he says, "With weapons, we defended Trieste. With weapons, we conquered our freedom." And it turned out that he was himself involved in weapon trafficking, and he was actually turning people into slaves to build weapons, and then he would sell them in the black market. And in his public speeches, he would say, "Oh, we need more weapons to defend our freedom," and blah blah blah. And each time I could listen to Donald Trump during his campaigns in 2016, it reminded me of this movie, because it was so obvious that you have this billionaire involved in the construction industry in the United States who was claiming in all his speeches, "Oh, we need a wall. We need a big wall." And we understood that his industrial sector would be the main beneficiary of building a wall with Mexico, which would have otherwise a lot of negative consequences. But
we study the case of the wall of Donald Trump, and what you have to know is that the wall was not needed, because it was in the middle of the desert. So there is a natural wall, which is the desert. It's like if you try to build a wall in the sea. You don't need to build a wall in the sea, because the sea is the wall. And in the case of what Donald Trump was saying he wanted to build was in the desert. That's why there was no wall there. Another thing interesting of the wall is that you're creating, and this is what we work with, you are creating a narrative of the otherness. There are two kinds of people, the ones within the wall and the ones outside the wall. And the ones outside the wall are the bad men, bad hombres. You remember that, Emmanuel? Mm-hmm. The bad hombres. So those ones are in the other side of the wall. And this narrative of the otherness worked very well with Trump, and it works very well with the alt-right, and it works very well with the industry of migration control. Like for controlling four guys coming from Sudan asking for status of refugee, you needed guns. You don't need guns. So.
Mm-hmm. And in your analysis of this question, so because if we want to take the position of those who promote this system, they will say, okay, unfortunately, there are terrible costs in migration control. We pay this industry, and so on and so forth. But we do that for the good cause, because if we were to let those people come, then we would have even more problems. So actually, that's a very bad system that has been emerging. It has enriched a lot of companies to build wall, biometric systems, and so on. But you know, at the end of the day, it would be even worse if we were not doing it. Have you tried to cover this aspect of the story?
Yes, because everything is the same. I mean, regularization has the part of the narrative and the speech that explains the other truth. No, the truth is that if you had a system where people could come in a regular way, so of course you will need offices, you will need people assisting, you will need good web pages so that people could fill online a form. You will need a system where you can see where you have more needs of workers in the whole Europe. You could do things that are working in places like Canada, New Zealand, or even Uganda, who have a system of allowing workers to move freely. So if we try that, And instead of investing money to build bigger walls at the end, they don't stop people from coming and they cause lots of pain. You create administrative systems who allow the flows to work. Probably it will work. It worked with the European Union when the borders were out. Everybody was very scared. Remember when Spain arrived to the European Union, all these guys are poor. They're going to come to France to work. I mean, nobody wants to go to France. We don't know French. So we stay in Spain. At the end, people, they move. Because they seek for a balance. If they don't find a job, they will go back to their country because they are not risking their lives. But if you have someone crossing the sea to come, and then when it arrives, it doesn't have work, it doesn't have what he expects, do you really think he's going to go back to their countries after risking their life to be here? And once they have their papers, normally they all go back to their country somehow. Or they began a system of really finding what they want in terms of wellness and stability. So yes. This is what I propose.
Yes, yes, I do agree with that. It's clear and that the circulation of people, allowing for the circulation of people, prevents them from overstaying in the destination countries. Likewise, in the United States and in Europe as well, you have people who stay in the destination countries because they know that if they go, they will not be able to come back. And it leads them to overstay, whereas probably they would be ready to check elsewhere if they have better opportunities. So they overstay in the US, they overstay in the UK, they overstay in France, in Spain, in Germany, because they know that they would not be able to come back. And also what I could say about that is that there is no need for complex bureaucracies to handle those people. I often listen to that is all we need to help those refugees to know what is good for them. But those people, as you said, have crossed the sea. They have taken enormous risks. Those who arrive have been able generally to overcome enormous challenges. And so it's not necessarily a bureaucrat in the office who is going to tell them what is good for them and what they need to do. Those people, they know what they could do. So, as you say, in a free system in which people are free to move, and also in a free labor market in which you don't have rigidities in the labor market that make that people see a country which is 10 times richer than their country of origin, and in which people tell them, oh no, sorry, there is no job for you. That sounds strange as well, no, isn't it? You are 20 times richer than in my home country, but there is no job for me, whereas I would be ready to do whatever I could to help here. Isn't it a little bit strange? So this is also related to rigidities, which are supposed to protect local workers. But at the end of the day, there is very little evidence that in practice, local workers benefit from all those rigidities, which then make it impossible for immigrants to find jobs. Policymakers have played a lot on this idea that, oh, you see those migrants are going to lead your wage down. So we need to really prevent them from taking any wage below this threshold. And the threshold happened to be...
Our researcher, our head of research, Gonzalo Fanjul, is an enormous expert on labor mobility. He is part of the Labor Mobility Partnership that is with people at Harvard. Well, it's a worldwide organization, and he is a representative of Spain. And he always talk about the cake. I like very much that. He says, when people see economy, they say a cake, and they think this cake is static. So people comes and they're going to eat the same amount of cake. What people, they don't realize is each people that arrives makes the cake grow. So everyone that comes, and this is what we presented in our regularization paper. Everything was about that. It was about every person that comes brings wellness, brings money, brings... so it's not that they're profiting of a cake. See, they're also creating more cake for everyone.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. But what I meant is that this some restrictions in destination countries precisely prevent them from growing the cake. Yes, and as a result, they become a problem.
No, it's a silly system. It's a system that is, we're doing mainly, and we all know that, we're doing the worst thing we can do. Potentially, there is nothing worse than what we're doing. So all right. This is why for us, the narrative was is so important, and the changing the vision and the perceptions was so important. It's very easy to talk about that with you because you're an expert on migration, but common people who they don't know about migration, they have these visions that you have presented now. No, they're wrong. They think they're afraid. Again, since like I was saying at the beginning, you have to think who you're talking to, because people are afraid. They're scared about things they don't know or things they think are different and they won't understand. So there's a big effort to do, like trying to teach, to bring knowledge, no more than teach.
Mm-hmm. So, and like you had this first story, I mean, the first we discussed, not the first for you, about Melilla, in which you highlighted that, oh, there is this tension in Melilla, but it's not simply related to migration flows. It's more related, actually, to the disturbances that or the unintended consequences of the policy framework and the abuse of this policy framework by certain actors. So, like you have done this story, are you trying to investigate this question of people who are afraid, as you have just said, people who are afraid of immigrants and we think that immigrants are going to take their share of the cake, and we see immigrants in their neighborhood and say, oh, there are major disturbances for us, and so on. Have you tried to already investigate this matter and cover some questions in concrete cases?
We do this kind of investigation about, for example, in the case of Melilla, it was corruption. And recently we have been part of the consortium. I don't know if you have seen the last news about the massacre in Melilla on the 24th of June. It was published by Le Monde, and we were part of this consortium too. So, and yes, we also work with anthropologists, sociologists, historians, and experts on communication and storytelling on what we call this new narrative based on how people feel. But as I told you before, we are not reactive. It's not like we look what people are saying, so we change it. It's we think about what we want the people to say, and we work to get them the information that will help them to talk in a different way. So we're not reactive, we're propositive. I don't know if that makes sense, if I was clear. So, yes. We have three big reports. We have big reports. They're not big. Three interesting reports. Two of them are in English, about how people feel, how audiences feel, and how, if you want to communicate to these audiences, you can provide with different messages using different, like some tips to be able to communicate better with them. But there are lots of studies, and we are part of a big project that is a research that you know very well called Bridget's. They are doing an analysis of how is the narrative on migration. For us, this is not really interesting. For us, it's more important to think how we would love the narrative of migration to be. So we work on deciding what we think this narrative has to be and how we make the people to rejoin this narrative.
And have you tried to do it as far as the welcoming or the acceptance of newcomers is concerned?
I mean, everything is a success. For example, when you bring the people to think about the migrants as a engine for economy, that's a success. And this is something that we have introduced in the public debate in Spain through through this thing of regularization. So it's not so simple as, like, there is no an equation when you're talking about perception and persuasion, and it's more fluid, but we've seen changes. For example, when, like 2 years ago, we launched this report, it was called Narratives of Love. Oh, it was last year. Oh my God, time goes. So not 2 years ago, last year, because it was in 2021. And it was about how people, they need to, for example, for us, the hate speech is a result of the need of community. And this is a way of seeing it that is not very common. But for us, it's clear that hate speech is the result of people looking for a community, and they get united because they hate a third. So that creates a community. So you share the hate with someone. So what we think is that we have to provide with messages and propositions full of love, which is another way to create community. So our understanding is that organizations should take that into account when they create the messages, when they create the narratives. And I don't know, but might be like 200 sessions of teaching new narratives this year in 2022. We've done 200 conferences and encounters on that. And as a result, there are lots of organizations doing different, presenting things in a very different way. The last campaign was sent to us today, an organization that we have been helping for 2 years to change the way they communicate. And they have done this beautiful campaign about the neighbor saying, the neighborhood is my neighborhood is your neighborhood, and it's about how the diversity of a neighborhood makes you greater. But it's told in a way that is so inspiring, and it's great, because those people 2 years ago were with this speech about the poor migrants and they need our help and we need to help them. And that was about otherness. And this time they've done a super big campaign paid by the government of Spain, by the way, about community and creating a diverse community and how diversity helps so much and make us stronger and greater. So
yeah, that's an interesting case. And what about the case you mentioned earlier of recognizing migrants as contributors for economic growth and development in the countries of destinations? Have you tried to work on cases about that, try to promote this view of migrants contributing to economic development?
When we began with the campaign of regularization and we arrived with these arguments of migrants helping the economy and so on, we were told because the lead of this campaign is an association of migrants, as I told you, the Regularización. And some of them were saying to us, this is not a question of, you were talking about us as if we were like tools, or, you know, it's like usability. And so it's a question of rights. And right now, I think that everybody agrees that, of course, is a question of rights, but it's also a question of presenting themselves to the society as part of it that enrich the society. And it's, I think this is something we have been working together with them. And I think it's, at the end, somehow we are all migrants. I mean, somehow all of us, we have moved, lived in other countries. Our culture is mixed. So at the end, is we are all part of the same, no? And right now, I think it has... last year, we have a Congress of Migration Journalism every year. You're all invited. You should come, Manuel. You would love it. It's in Merida, it's every year. This year is from the 19th to the 21st of April. Normally it's in October, but we have the elections. So we were asked to do it in April, and we're going to do it. And we did it? That in Merida. Where? Merida, Spain. Okay. Merida, Extremadura.
Extremadura, same. Mm-hmm.
So, but we launch a bus from Madrid to Merida to go. just stay there 2 days, only with people of the Congress, because there is nothing else to do. Of course, Merida is a magnificent city, Roman. It was capital of the Roman Empire during lots of years, and it's full of Roman historical things. It's an amazing city. And we did this. We took three of the migration journalists in three main media in Spain, and we did an analysis of the titles. It was very silly. We took all the within the section of migration all the titles, and we counted the words, and it like 80%. So we said to them, you talk about migration only as if it was a crisis. And they were there, no, we talk about everything. No. Mainly as if it was a crisis, because we have analyzed all the titles and 80% is a crisis. Ah, no, but that was because this year we had the Canary Island. And at the end, when everything finished, Maria Martin, she is amazing. She's the one covering migrations in El País. She came and she said, it was hard to be there because you were right. You were right. So the challenge was that we put them with those women of regularization ya to talk about the economy of migrations. And Maria has changed the way she depicts migration in El País. She has included much more content of economy and profiles of workers and when within her section. So it is a success that to get the editorial line of a paper change, and through these things that we do, through this Congress of Migration, through the papers, we get that. So they are like very small things, but at the end, these things are, as I was saying at the beginning, the seed of the change. Information is the beginning of any change. So,
yeah, very interesting. So, what we have seen so far is that you are interested in providing this is a so-called evidence-based approach to a question, and to try to highlight the distortion of the question in the way people talk about it, and highlight that there are other challenges that are not covered. For instance, the corruption around the public money to control migration, or the permanent sense of crisis, the permanent sense that immigrants are a threat, or even, and it's more vicious, the idea that migrants need to be helped. Because if migrants need to be helped, the assumption is that they are a burden. So that in itself is more vicious. So, and if, even we were mentioning about that, this idea that all migrants, those poor migrants, they would need a bureaucrat telling them what they have to do, telling them where they can find a job, and so on. All this assumes that they are going to be a burden for social services, whereas it's more than likely that without bureaucratic interferences, they would find a way. And if they don't find it, they would go elsewhere for most of them. But the question is, why do you think we have so many distortions when it comes to migration? Why did that the default narrative seems to be migration is dangerous, migration is a burden, we need to control migration, and we avoid the rest? So why do you think that, what are the forces that shape this default approach, you think?
I think it is, I mean, I think it's just a temporal pattern.
Sorry?
I think it's just a temporal fashion. I don't think it's going to last.
It's a fashion.
It's a narrative fashion, somehow, that helps to create a sense of community against a third. So the same way you have races, or you have heteropatriarchate. So it's a trend, and it is used because migrants don't vote. So it's very easy to create a situation where you go against someone who is a vote you're never going to get. You're not losing anything, and you can gain, really. It helps also to go beyond the red lines. It crosses red lines very easily because it's like racism, but the fight for racism is older. So there are some steps ahead that they have. Still, racism is terrible, and we are very racist in Europe. But for migration, everything is so new. Because it's true that you have had narrative anti-migration and so on. It always have been there. But it is like a very transversal, because migration really is nothing. Migrant is someone that is moving from a place to another. So at the end, when we're talking about migrants in the narratives, we're not talking about migrants. We're talking about specific migrants who have a phenotype, who have a specific situation. So it's more about, at the end, is you're using like vulnerable communities who cannot vote to create a hate and a community through hate. But I think everything passes. In Spain, in the 90s, we had all these people coming from South America. And probably thanks to the public system of education and health, there was an integration that it happens because the public system of health, for example, is the best one, is better than the private one. So at the end, you get to be with all these people, not in the same using the same resources, but there was racism against Latin America. And right now, the hate speech in Spain against migrants is not focused on Latin American populations. Because after 20 years, they're part of our history. They're part of our community. It's more about Arab people. And there you can have this Islamophobia. is more about black people, and you have racism. Is more about young people from Morocco. But young people, they always have been part of, is one of the most scary things in a society that is getting old. And we are getting very old in Europe. And people are very scared about young people.
Yeah, it was very interesting, everything you said. But you mentioned several times something, that is, you referred to the fact migrants don't vote, and you also referred again to this idea that hate speech is a way to build community. And so implicitly, I think you were referring also to those politicians, and you have some of them in Spain as well, who are precisely going to use this question to promote their political career. And but also we mentioned the public money at in Melilla. So here we come back to a broader question, which is, what is the role of public authorities into all that? Because even far right politicians, even if you take Marine Le Pen in France or politicians of the same style in Spain, they are part of the public system. They campaign to get the public offices. They receive public money. And so they are part of the public system to some extent. And when the European Commission also funds associations, NGOs, and invest in Melilla in certain way, they don't want to hear that all this money is misused. They don't want to hear about that. What they want to say that this money was very useful. This money fulfills a social function, and likewise, you have public authorities at the national level who say that okay, migration is can be also dangerous. That is, it's a way of legitimation for public authorities. That's it. That public authorities at the national or the European level draw parts of their legitimacy into their capacity in convincing the public that migration is something dangerous. And
I think there is a bilateral relation. I mean, I think people need something that creates community. You're not providing them with anything that is inspiring, and you can find a responsible for everything. So you misuse the public money, but the responsible is the migrant who is going through, you know, he's attacking the country like it happened in Melilla, no? So you have more than 37 people died in the same day, all young people from Sudan. Probably there were 100 people dying there this day. But as we know right now, 37. Okay. And the responsible for that are the migrants trying to go through the fence, attacking. So it's a very easy way not to get any responsibility about anything.
So, yes, it is. In those cases, they deny, but also in those more broadly, this is that, yes, you have governments or public organizations or even NGOs, as you mentioned, but paid by with public money, that derives their meaning, their sense of necessity. From this question, that is, say, oh, we are necessary, because if we were not intervening, then it would be the chaos. It would be the chaos without us.
Yeah, and this is what we were saying at the beginning, Emmanuel. It's like the industry of the migration control is very wide. And it's a pity, but there are organizations who might even be with a very good will. But as you were saying, I mean, when you see otherness, the speech of otherness is a disaster. And it helps not to take responsibilities of what you're doing wrong. It helps governments to give something that unites people because it's against another person who is not a voter. And it's very easy to talk about that and not to talk about the economy or not to talk about what are your plans for development of the country when you don't have any plan.
Or so, when all your previous plans have failed.
when all your previous plans have failed. So it's very, it's like a distortion, no?
Yes, the most interesting in election is when you have the competitor who makes the assessment of the economic impact of the policies of the previous government. This is generally the most accurate in elections. But anyway, yes, and as you say, they want to create a sense of belonging, but among people who are voters, because you could create also a sense of belonging that is trans-communitarian, that goes beyond the voters of a particular country, but they want to create a sense of community among voters, which is a way also to enhance the legitimacy of the state.
But you know that is proof that this is not long lasting. I mean, you see what are the more successful governors in the world, and the most successful is the Prime Minister of New Zealand. In the second election, she got voted by the 85% of the country. Mm-hmm. Her speech is all about creation of community. Mm-hmm. Justin Trudeau might be very wrong in some things, but his speech is about creating community. Everything is about how Canada is a country full of people that came from other places, and Canada is built from different communities working together, and this is the Canadian spirit. The speech of Canada, the narrative of Canada is brutal, and Trudeau is very well. He has a super high rate of value in his country.
Is it Trudeau or the New Zealand Prime Minister before COVID, or you still think they are in this line? Because I understood that during COVID, both Canada and New Zealand adopted extremely harsh measures, including locking down the borders, preventing people from
yes.
at some point. So maybe you refer to the period before COVID, no?
No.
Even now.
New Zealand was very close for preventing the COVID to get to the island. But the way the speech of the Prime Minister is built, it's about community creation. It's not about hate. It's not about COVID measures might not be the best ones, but COVID was a very extreme situation. And I don't think anyone did it in the right way. Mm-hmm. In Spain, we were locked like a lot. Very locked during months. And but you couldn't prevent, we didn't prevent the people to come. We were not in an island. In New Zealand, they prevent the people to come and they avoid to have the COVID. But I think this is a very special situation. But the way the public narrative is construct, it's about construction of community. And it's long lasting, really. At the end, the people, in Los Angeles, they have also what they call Los Angelinos, which is a community that is based on the fact that most of the people in Los Angeles are migrants. And it's also a narrative of the community. Those narratives, they work and they are long lasting, much more than hate. Hate is quicker. But when you think you're part of a community,
all right, very interesting. These various cases. So let's discuss a last point, maybe in this episode, which is about more entrepreneurship. In your case, we have talked about that a lot, but could you tell me, as much as you would like, of course, how you are funded, in what you do? Do you receive some money for your services, or it's mostly about donations how are you funded exactly at Porkhauser?
We have a very different ways of funding. Most of them is private money.
Donations, you mean, or for services?
Donations represent 35% of our budget.
35. Almost
35, 40. Mm-hmm. Private donations, individual donation.
All right.
We have two big donors and lots of small donors. We need to increase our community. This is what we have to fight for the next 3 years, especially the small donors, because it's the most strong support. It gives lots of having lots of small donors. It's a guarantee of sustainability. You don't lose. It's very hard. I mean, you have to do something terrible to lose the donors. And our budget is very small. So we don't need so many. And we have 20% or 25% from the budget are reports and conferences and seminars and things like that that we are part of.
And who pays for those reports? Are these public bodies or private
all
clients?
Even if they are public bodies, they are not contracting us as a public body. So it's like private needs of mainly NGOs. NGOs also in the reports. For example, we have worked with Save the Children, Oxfam, these kinds of organizations, sometimes UNICEF. They need a special report, and we help them with that. And we co-sign the report. This is normally very interesting. They put the advocacy part outside of the report. I mean, like, we don't sign the advocacy part because we are not prescriptors, as I told you. We are just, we provide with information, but we don't give the... We don't advise what you have to do to change the situation. This is something that is, and for the trainings and the conferences and the consultancies, even governments and lots. I mean NGOs. I mean, I don't know. Maybe we have been working this year with 50. 60 NGOs, from all kinds of NGOs. Lots of networks of NGOs, like ask us for trainings everywhere in the world. Like last week, I did a masterclass on new narratives in Mexico online. So in Latin America, we work a lot. We do lots of trainings there too.
All right. So,
and the rest of the budget. Right now, we have two European projects, but it's the last time we're going to do something like that. We didn't know how it was, and we are not an organization to be part of European projects. They are the way they you need to do the things, and it's more important like the accountability of the project than the project itself. And for us, it's not public money is always complicated. At the end, we thought the European Union was not public money, but it is. So we're too small and we don't have the capacity to do it the way it needs to be done. And so it's something that normally we don't want to do again. So we want to walk really out of any source of public money because it's very tedious. And at the end, our independence is so important for us. So,
just about this question, you say the problem was about the accountability rules, but you also mentioned independence.
Yes, because I mean, what is for sure is like national money will make you dependent on public money. Like, the dependency on public money has been one of the curses of the NGOs, at least in Spain. I don't know very well the rest, because, for example, I know that in the UK they have very strong support for populations, and in Germany too, people are used to give money to the NGOs and be part of the NGOs. In Spain, no. Fundraising in Spain is very hard. So NGOs have been supported by national public funding, and it's terrible because at the end, you are not independent. Yeah. It's impossible.
Yes. So you have donations, including from small donors. You have European projects with which you have some concerns, and in between you have training and some kind of consultancy. So let's zoom in on those last two. That is, why do why do organizations contract you for a training? For instance, you refer to Mexico, or for a consultancy. Could you give a concrete example to understand their needs and what they expect from you?
We have this system that we call circular narrative, which is a system to get information and produce information. One of the supports are the reports. So we do this procedure of creating information in a very specific way, and it works. So most of the people, they come whether to ask us to do this retrieve of information the way we do it for them. So like Save the Children will tell us, we want to do something about childhood and migration, and then we will work. For example, what we did with them, and it was our idea. They wanted to do something with children and migration, but they didn't know what. And then we said, because we were with this thing of the regularization and the irregular people, and so we said, why you don't check how many regular children are in Spain? Because their families don't have papers. They don't have papers neither. So we did this story. It was amazing. It was because nobody ever knew that in Spain there were like 150,000 children without papers that were living with their families. And nobody thought about the consequences of that. They cannot go with their friends in a tour. It was beautiful. We did that together with a team of research and journalism. So there were interviews, and we interviewed all these children and the mothers, and we did an amazing work. So this is what we can offer to organizations. But there are organizations who want to learn to do the things the way we do it. So we train them, and we try to help them to change some of the patterns on the way they confront the information, and they look for it, and then they produce the information, the supports they use, and so on. Mm-hmm. And there you have from the way you can address the information, or new narratives, which is the way you can talk about migration to really create a narrative of that naturalized migration and makes it what it is, seen as something that is part of our humanity, you know? To understand the audiences you are addressing to, or to create systems to reach wider audiences, or work on network. So this is what we we train the organizations for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. So, so yes, actually, you try to change the way actors look at questions. Try to broaden the vision of certain actors on certain issues that are relevant to them, in order to help them have a broader view of the question to and satisfy some of their needs in the process.
No, it's very concrete.
That's why it was very helpful to discuss concrete cases. But
it's very easy if you remember that we were created to answer to a problem. The problem was that audiences were disconnected with information. This is something that any organization is noticing, because they're producing tons of information that is not consumed. So what they come to us is to tell us, I mean, we want to do information that is consumed. How can we do that? Mm-hmm. So one, we help you and we do it together. Two, we teach you how we are doing it and you try, because our system works. Mm-hmm. So it's very specific. It's always to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. So. Thank you very much, Lucila, for presenting the activities of Por Causa and delving into concrete cases of what you have done. It was very interesting what you said about Melia, and also about this regularization question in Spain, and the way you try to talk about migration in order also to change to change. The way a lot of people see this question. All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Lucila. It was very nice and very informative.
Thank you to have me.